Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Tuesday evening Dhamma class at Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on April 18, 2017. My Dhamma talk and our Sangha discussion is on the seven factors the Buddha taught to cultivate and develop the qualities necessary for awakening. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation. Thank you. Peace. So, tonight's talk is on the seven factors of enlightenment. There are seven factors of enlightenment taught by the Buddha that are to be cultivated and developed further for enlightenment to be realized. In the Galana Sutta, the Buddha teaches Sariputta's brother Kunda these seven factors and then concludes with teaching Kunda the ultimate purpose of the Dhamma, to be empty of clinging to material gain or status or offerings or unskillful ambitions or clinging to unskillful associations. This last, clinging to unskillful associations, is an ongoing theme throughout the Pali Canon and refers to the unskillfulness and difficulties that arise from clinging to beliefs and practices that have become a part of Dhamma practice but are not part of what the Buddha taught. And even during the Buddha's time, there was this a constant push and excuse for incorporating other practices that were floating around at the time. And I won't get into all the reasons, but they're kind of obvious. Due to conditioned thinking, it can be very difficult to recognize unskillful practices that have developed from one's associations, and even more difficult to abandon these teachings due to pure self-identification. It is by cultivating these seven factors within the framework of the Eightfold Path that all self-referential views rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths can be recognized and abandoned, and that's really the purpose of the Buddha's teachings. The Galana Sutta. One evening, the Buddha, while lying ill, was approached by Sariputta's... I got to make a comment there. I got an email from one of the online students, almost in a panic. He says, "You mean the Buddha could actually get sick?" And I'm reading between the lines, but after I talked, I realized it was true. He was really looking at the Dhamma as a way of escaping humanity. When the Buddha was about living a life fully as a human being and not avoiding any of life. So even in a situation like this, the Buddha was in a status way like the king. And when he was sick, he could have I don't want to be bothered. Leave me alone. But he didn't. He recognized his position. He also recognized that the illness that he's feeling is temporary, part of being a human being, and he is still an awakened one with a task in front of him, to teach Kunda. The Buddha spoke directly to Kunda to plant the seed of understanding in his mind. "Venerable Kunda, let these seven factors of enlightenment arise in your mind. These seven factors of enlightenment are well expounded and are cultivated and fully developed by one awakened. They bring perfect understanding, full realization, and nibbana." Nibbana means awakening, gaining awakening. So what are these seven? The Buddha begins with, mindfulness is a factor of enlightenment. Mindfulness is carefully taught by the Buddha. That's an important line. Mindfulness is not something that was broadly taught by the Buddha. It was carefully taught and specifically taught in two applications. One is the four foundations of mindfulness that we use primarily in meditation. And the other way that he used mindfulness was to be mindful of each factor of the Eightfold Path. And no other way. That was enough, because that's enough to develop the entire Eightfold Path, and it avoids using mindfulness in a way that could be just simply another distraction, which is somewhat what's happened in the modern applications of mindfulness. And that's not to say that there hasn't been benefit to them, but for someone focused on, to these other applications of mindfulness, I should say. But for developing the Dhamma, it's important to remember that mindfulness is used in two applications. Mindfulness is a factor of enlightenment. Mindfulness is carefully taught by the Buddha. Mindfulness is cultivated and fully developed by one awakened. Mindfulness brings perfect understanding, full realization, and nibbana. Next, investigation of the Dhamma is a factor of enlightenment. In other words, if we want to develop anything, but if we want to develop the Dhamma, you have to actually investigate it. And the Buddha's talking somewhat specifically to investigating the Eightfold Path, but then also investigating how his other teachings apply to developing the Eightfold Path and developing an understanding of Four Noble Truths. Investigation of the Dhamma is carefully taught by the Buddha. Investigation of the Dhamma is cultivated and fully developed by one awakened. Investigation of the Dhamma brings perfect understanding and full realization and nibbana. Investigation of the Dhamma is carefully taught by the Buddha. One of the things that, one of those aha moments hit me like a ton of bricks when I got it. And this came after reading a lot of the Pali Canon and finally realizing that the Buddha never wasted a teaching. In fact, I don't think he ever wasted a word in relation to developing understanding of Four Noble Truths. Everything he ever taught was in that context. He wasn't teaching conceptual applications of compassion, conceptual applications of honesty, conceptual applications of true love, meaning skillful love, conceptual applications of even things like right livelihood, because he understood that to teach in concepts or to teach things such as a doctrine of compassion as something to achieve was unachievable to a conditioned mind. But he also understood that if he could develop a way to address conditioned mind, then these skillful qualities that we all aspire to, compassion, honesty, equanimity in all of our affairs, are a natural expression of an awakened human being, but cannot be grasped after or conceptually applied. They're carefully taught. The way to developing that, these things that we all aspire to, are carefully taught by the Buddha through developing the Eightfold Path. Persevering effort is a factor of enlightenment. Persevering effort is carefully taught by the Buddha. Persevering effort is cultivated and fully developed by one awakened. Persevering effort brings perfect understanding, full realization, and nibbana. It just means that we have to keep going. And that's important. Every one of us, including myself, as we're developing the Dhamma, has had periods of doubt or maybe just tired of the whole thing. And it's in the Buddhist, a factor of enlightenment is to recognize that this is a temporary state. It's part of conditioned thinking. Let me keep going. It's one of the reasons why I say we need to be very gentle with ourselves. And it's when we're falling into that doubt or the, you know, whatever the hindrance might be, to remember that the most gentle thing we can do for ourselves, the most loving thing we can do for ourselves, is to continue. Joyful engagement in the Dhamma is a factor of enlightenment. Joyful engagement is carefully taught by the Buddha. Why shouldn't we be full of joy when we recognize that an awakened human being left the path to developing awakening, full human maturity, for all of us to develop? That should bring joyful engagement, shouldn't it? And it's also just a reminder when persevering effort seems like we just can't muster it up, to remember that one thing, that all that we have to do to develop a life of lasting peace and happiness is to develop this simple Eightfold Path. We don't have to go out and figure it out ourselves. It's already been done. An awakened human being has done that. All that we have to do is basically follow directions. And they're not all that difficult. So that should bring joyful engagement. Joyful engagement in the Dhamma is cultivated and fully developed by one awakened. Joyful engagement in the Dhamma brings perfect understanding, full realization, and nibbana. Tranquility is a factor of enlightenment. And that's one of the things that we develop in meditation, isn't it? It's one translation of the word shamatha is tranquility, or a quiet mind. Tranquility is a factor of enlightenment. Tranquility is carefully taught by the Buddha. Tranquility is cultivated and fully developed by one awakened. Tranquility brings perfect understanding, full realization, and nibbana. Concentration is a factor of enlightenment. Concentration is carefully taught by the Buddha. This isn't part of the sutta, but that's the purpose of shamatha, vipassana, meditation within the proper framework. To deepen concentration, to develop one of the most important of these seven factors of enlightenment. Concentration is cultivated and fully developed by one awakened. Concentration brings perfect understanding, full realization, and nibbana. These are my words, my comments here. Tranquility and concentration are both the focus and the purpose of shamatha vipassana meditation when practiced within the framework of the Eightfold Path. The next factor, the seventh factor, is equanimity. Equanimity is a factor of enlightenment. Equanimity is carefully taught by the Buddha. Equanimity is cultivated and fully developed by one awakened. Equanimity brings perfect understanding, full realization, and nibbana. My words, equanimity is the ongoing quality of an awakened, fully mature human being. But we all experience that at times. If we're not yet awakened, it doesn't last. But even in meditation, we'll have even momentary experiences of equanimity, meaning that our mind is simply at peace. It's not bouncing around. It's balanced. It's continually mindful of what's occurring. And again, in the beginning of meditation, that might only be for a moment or two, but it's important to recognize that we've developed that even just for a moment. The Buddha is also pointing back to the jhanas, and I've talked about that, the four levels of meditative absorption. And the fourth level is equanimity. In meditation, it's important to recognize that we've achieved that fourth level, again, even if it's just for a brief moment, but also to understand that's what we are developing towards. That's what a fully awakened, fully mature human being, that's what their mind is like. When the Buddha described the mind of an awakened human being, he used one word, calm, which is another word for equanimity, but it stays there. The Buddha continues, these seven factors of enlightenment are carefully taught by the Buddha, and all seven are cultivated and fully developed by one awakened. These seven factors of enlightenment bring perfect understanding, full realization, and nibbana. In my words, nibbana means extinguished, as in the fires of passion arising from ignorance of Four Noble Truths have been extinguished through direct engagement with the Eightfold Path. Those that were at last year's retreat, remember the fire discourse, the Adita Parayana Sutta. That's the third sutta that the Buddha ever gave, teaching that the purpose, the cause of dukkha is comes from the arising of our own passions, rooted in ignorance, and the cessation of dukkha is the cessation of these passions. And that's one of the themes of this year's retreat also. Therefore, the Buddha continues, therefore train yourselves to continue to abandon clinging to material gain, clinging to status, clinging to offerings, clinging to unskillful ambitions, and clinging to unskillful associations. I got another interesting email from one of my students this week, and he was asking about, he was rather high up in a corporate structure, and he was explaining that it took a lot of drive and determination to achieve the level that he had achieved. And he was concerned that if you let go of that drive, what's going to happen to his status? He hadn't quite yet understood letting go, clinging to that status. But I pointed out to him that the Buddha didn't have to chase after the status of being an awakened human being and sought after by nearly every person of importance in his time. He simply lived his life. He didn't have to continually chase after achievement. His expression of who he was achievement enough. In fact, it was beyond anything, any type of achievement. And his teachings are still here today. Now think about that in relation to this very competitive and status-driven world that we live in. He's still acknowledged 2,600 years ago, a man that gave up all ambition at the age of 36 is still remembered for what he did in the following years after he gave up all ambition and simply expressed himself as a fully awakened human being. Still affecting the world today, still affecting what's going on right in this room. Just my words there to conclude this sutta. The Buddha consistently described awakening as released or empty of clinging. That's the end of the sutta. These seven factors of enlightenment are first to be cultivated. Like an untouched garden holds the potential for useful and purposeful crops, our minds hold the potential for useful and purposeful insight and resulting awakening. Every one of us holds the potential to develop as the Buddha awakened, simply another human being. He taught a path for all other human beings to do the same thing if they so chose. And these seven factors are to be cultivated until we're at the point of awakening, full maturity, and then they're simply part of our lives. But if we can look at any one of these, let's use equanimity as an example. We recognize that right at this point in our lives, we might not have lasting equanimity. But if we want to cultivate it, what do? Continue with engaging the Eightfold Path. If we recognize that right now I'm kind of ambiguous about my Dhamma teaching, how do I cultivate it? By engaging in the Dhamma. Cultivate these practices. They're not, because of conditioned thinking, they're not an inherent and useful part of every human being's life because of that conditioned thinking. But they're factors that each and every one of us can cultivate if we have the right framework for cultivating that. Again, that's why the Buddha taught an Eightfold Path. I'm just going to go a little bit further. As one would cultivate a new garden by preparing the soil, choosing appropriate seeds, meaning choosing the appropriate teachings, mindfully planting the seeds to allow for proper development and ongoing attention, the Dhamma is to be cultivated as well. With a focused mindfulness of the Buddha's Dhamma, distraction is minimized. To fully develop the innate quality of mindfulness, mindfulness must be exercised. Mindfulness means to hold in mind. Holding in mind the Buddha's Dhamma, one remains focused on first awakening to the Four Noble Truths. One avoids the distractions of other dharmas, disciplines, or ideas. Cultivating mindfulness, these qualities are factors of enlightenment, incline the mind towards awakening. They all lead to developing discernment as to the what, where, and how of Dhamma practice. Like today, during the Buddha's time, there were many distractions to other ideas and practices, seemingly helpful or even necessary towards gaining understanding. As a subtle aspect of conditioned thinking, it can be very difficult to recognize and abandon contradictory practices that one has become associated with and enamored of. The Eightfold Path provides the framework for recognizing and abandoning unskillful practices. The story of the distraction and schism created by Devadatta, the Buddha's cousin, is an archetypal story of the damage done by allowing grasping, aversion, and deluded thinking to interfere with cultivation of the Dhamma. Devadatta achieved a certain level of intuitive powers through preliminary development, and it's not something that we should chase after, it's just something that happened with Devadatta. Devadatta gained little initial wisdom or discernment, probably because he was more enamored with gaining these certain powers to set himself apart. He decided that he had a more comprehensive understanding than the Buddha. Devadatta was driven by the need to establish himself as an enlightened being. He wanted to introduce his own Dhamma. Devadatta plotted to have the Buddha killed so that he could take over the Sangha. He succeeded in distracting 500 monks to follow him. I won't get into the whole story, but the plot failed, and most of the monks returned to the Buddha Sangha. The Buddha used this situation as an opportunity to teach mindfulness of the Dhamma and point out the dangers of heedfulness. And this is from the Devadatta Sutta, just an excerpt from it. The Buddha teaches, distracted by 8 untrue Dhammas, his mind overcome, Devadatta is headed for a state of further ignorance and confusion. What are these 8? Distracted by clinging to material gain. Again, he's referring right back to these 7 factors in this way. Distracted by clinging to lack of material gain. Distracted by status. Distracted by lack of status. And imagine the quality of mind that he's describing to the monks there. This mind that's going back and forth from seeking status and then being upset that it hasn't quite achieved it yet. Seeking material gain and then realizing there's not enough there. You can never satisfy an ego personality, can you? Distracted by offerings of praise and goods and distracted by lack of offering of praise and goods. What an awful mind state to be stuck in. Distracted by clinging to ambition, distracted by unwholesome associations. His mind overcome, Devadatta is headed for a state of further ignorance and confusion. It's for this compelling reason that one should keep abandoning clinging, craving, and any unwholesome association and unwholesome friendship. You should train yourselves. I will keep abandoning again and again any clinging to material gain, any clinging to lack of material gain, any clinging to status, any clinging to lack of status, any clinging to offerings of praise and goods, any clinging to offerings of not offerings of praise and goods, any clinging to ambition, any clinging to unwholesome friendships or associations. This is how you should train yourselves. That's the end of that excerpt. There's about 25% left in that article if you want to read it, but that's enough to gain this understanding. In a very simple and direct way, the Buddha's teaching that there's qualities of mind to develop and also to recognize that we have developed them as a support to our ongoing Dhamma practice. And these are things that naturally flow from letting go of self-referential views, from letting go of all those things that are rooted in ignorance of the Four Noble Truths. And they directly lead to developing a life of calm and lasting peace and happiness. But right here, right now, again, it's not. This isn't like a carrot on a stick that we can trudge through this awful Dhamma practice, but then at the end we'll be rewarded with awakening and a calm and peaceful mind. Most of us have the experience of gradually developing this, and almost immediately as we take to Dhamma practice, at least the way it's, the Buddha teaches it, we recognize the benefits, don't we? So maybe as we go around the room, let's talk about that, the benefits that you've gained already from your Dhamma practice. But are there any questions about this, what I've talked about tonight? Yes, Lorna.
It's asking us to look at clinging and craving, but really isn't the underlying problem of clinging and craving, is that aversion? Aversion is the problem. Clinging and craving is what you see as behavior.
You're asking a very deep and somewhat subtle question. Craving follows clinging, and another aspect, aversion is just the other side of the same coin of craving or desire. So aversion is the desire that something not happen or that I be rid of something. And then we create an identity over that, don't we? Because our mind has reacted and we're clinging to that need now. So recognizing clinging is recognizing that process of creating identities over things that we want and things that we don't want that are occurring in our lives. So does that answer your question?
But where does aversion come into that? Wherever you have clinging and craving, do you always have aversion or not?
No.
No.
Not in that sense. Because, again, if we're clinging that something doesn't occur that we've already experienced, that's clinging to aversion. If we're clinging towards something, I always use chocolate cake, to wanting that next piece of chocolate cake or making sure I got the rest of it in the refrigerator for tomorrow, silly explanation, but that's clinging to that craving, to that seemingly positive experience. So we can cling ourselves to anything that gives a reaction in our minds, a disturbance in our minds. So clinging isn't just aversion. I think I see where you're going with this. Isn't because clinging is what keeps the problem of dukkha going? Isn't that ultimately aversion? And I guess you could qualify it that way, but it's not really the best way to look at aversion. Aversion is simply another aspect of craving and desire, and clinging follows from that. So, did I clarify that?
Yeah.
What would be the opposite of aversion?
Craving for something in a positive way.
Yeah.
It's just another... Aversion is craving.
Desire. Would be,
desire.
Would be the opposite of aversion.
Yep, craving or desire. It's not really the opposite. It's the same thing. Aversion is the same as craving. It's just... But it's maybe you could say it's negative craving.
Right.
You know. Lorna, you had another follow-up to that?
No.
Well, if you think of it... Well, is that confusing what I just said, that aversion is simply another side of...
Well, they all have equal power, if you want to put it that way.
Yeah.
Craving and aversion are equal in...
If you want to look at it as a positive is one side of the coin, negative is the other side of the coin, desire is wanting something that we feel is helpful or supportive or enjoyable, and the other side of that same coin is aversion, is not wanting anything that might take away from our pleasure. But it's all craving and clinging. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's all craving and desire.
It's all I'm making.
Through clinging, we create an identity of what I like, what I don't like. Remember, when the Buddha described dukkha, this is where we can get, where a conditioned mind wants to get too analytical and not see what's right in front of our face. Dukkha is aging, sickness, birth, aging, sickness, and death, not getting what is wanted, receiving what is not wanted, in short, the Buddha concluded that was always by saying, in short, the five clinging aggregates are dukkha. What does that mean? So the five clinging aggregates are simply describing the personal experience of not getting what you want or getting what you don't want, and then reacting to the common human problems of sickness, aging, and death. Frank?
The thought was almost as gone as quickly as...
Sorry.
I was sitting here thinking that when I have a desire and I feel that desire, it always leads me back to more desire.
Yes.
And then to clinging, craving and clinging and maintaining. And then it leads to attachment. And not wanting to lose what I have that brings pleasure. And it's a strong attachment. And then that leads me into a mind frame of not wanting to lose it. Trying to avoid that. You know? And that leads to a very unpeaceful mind frame.
And again, another word for attachment is clinging. And once we have made that attachment, once we are clinging to something and created a view over that, you can see how that can now direct our life toward doing what we can to maintain the object of our desire. Meaning it literally changes the direction our life might go in.
Which is what I want ultimately avoid.
Freedom in that. It leads to what the Buddha was, and what I kind of pointed out too, by the chasing after status is that. We've created an identity. That status will help protect. If I can achieve or maintain a certain status, then I can protect all the things that I want, and I can hopefully avoid all the things that I don't want, simply because of this position I've created for myself. And so you spend your entire life satisfying that view, which can't be satisfied.
Well, it puts me at the mercy of people, places, and things when I'm in that mind frame.
Absolutely. Good. Then it feels like the whole world is pulling your strings. I'm so fortunate that I developed drug addiction and alcoholism, because that's such an extreme example of craving and clinging. And it brought me, at a very early age, twice in my life, I started having consequences when I was 12 years old. By the time I was 26, I was literally within days of dying, and I knew it, but the only thing I wanted was another drink. Again, I'm just using myself as an extreme example of where craving for an experience and clinging to that experience can take us. But all of humans' ills are rooted in that ignorance that drives craving and clinging. We create views that we think are right, and we'll do anything. Once those views are created and we're stuck on them, we're attached to them, we will do anything. I'm talking now in general as a human population. We will do anything to continue to maintain those views. And in some cases, it rises to the incredible level that we have in our present life. We have, not getting political, but we have this whole thing in Korea just got me going crazy. We got a leader of a tiny little country who everybody knows is certifiably insane. Again, it's just, I'm not putting him down by using those words. We know that. People get insane in this world because of this problem. And he has a capability to kill millions if he decides to. This is the world. I'm not trying to get everybody upset or anything. This is the effect of this thinking that's rooted in ignorance. And again, we're not all going to end up like whatever his name is. I can't think of it right now. But on a very small level, we all experience that kind of crazy thinking that somehow we can control other things and control the world and control the experiences that we have in the world by gaining a certain status or having a certain position. When the Buddha teaches that all things are impermanent, nothing carries a way of sustaining a self within it. Let it go and live at peace with life as life occurs. I had this thought the other day just when I don't spend too much time listening to news because it's just too distracting, but I have been more in the last 6 months than ever in the last 10 years. That, and I don't mean this to bring us all down. It's just an observation of the craziness of where this deluded thinking can take us. I'm 61 years old. Going back about 25 years before that to the present time, over 100 million human beings have lost their lives from some type of violence. Isn't that a, I mean, that's just shocking. Well, I checked it out because I had this thought. I was just thinking, how many, and who knows exactly, but it might be low. That should be enough to shock every one of us. What the hell is going on? Excuse my language. But yet we so want to continue the ignorance that our thinking is rooted in that we can't even see it. We can't even recognize it. This is what the Buddha said. The world is exactly the same as it was now, except the prospect of instant global annihilation wasn't there then. But there was just as much competitiveness and violence. When the Buddha described the Four Noble Truths, he wasn't describing it just in a offhanded way, like, guess what, dukkha happens. He was also describing the cause of all human problems. Excuse me for getting so excited tonight, but it's been on my mind. And it leads to this. How can we not want to find a solution to this? And can't we, I mean, again, I'm talking about the common human problem today, the common human psyche. The things we've been doing in my lifetime haven't worked. It's getting crazier and crazier, isn't it? Time to look at something different. Why don't we look at, we know that there's at least one awakened human being, and he left us his teaching. Why don't we look at it? Again, so I'm getting beyond our sangha here. We're fortunate enough that we have it and we developed it and we can maintain a life of peace and happiness no matter what's occurring. But it's hard not to notice what's occurring, isn't it, Frank?
I was going to make a comment about the neurosis and the psychosis that you see, that I see on a day-to-day basis. People suffering with anxiety and panic attacks and anger issues and just complete mayhem and chaos.
Yeah.
The best thing we can do for the world is
meditate.
Well,
within the Eightfold Path.
I mean, it really is. And that's why I say it. And again, I'm not saying that because it will save the world. I mean, it would. But again, the Buddha didn't see himself as a savior. He didn't teach a salvific religion.
Well, save is the wrong word, but the best thing we can do to help.
Yeah, at least we won't be contributing to the problem. And we can be an example. I mean, that's what the Buddha was. You heard me talk about the King Ashoka, his bloodthirsty, probably the most bloodthirsty ruler the world has ever seen. He came across the Buddha's teaching, developed it, awakened, and never harmed another soul. You know, that's the potential that the Dhamma has for everyone. But
maybe we have to send Kim Jong-un some data.
It's a good idea because at least, I mean, I don't have any agitated mind over him. But it's there, you know. This is a realistic situation, and it doesn't do anybody any good, including me and including the world, the human society at large, to make believe this isn't occurring. That's part of ignorance. Ignorance through 12 observable causative links leads to all manner of suffering. What's it, Kim Jong-un? He is an example of. He's an extreme example of what happens from ignorance. You know, that's that. But what's the
surrounding yourself with people that aren't interested in having it be any other way?
Well, that's really important too. But all, thanks for saying it. It's interesting you say it. All of the most brutal people that we've experienced in our lifetime or through history depended on other ignorant people, very ignorant people, to follow them. It's the only way that they can survive. You know, we have to. You know, we have to do it. Again, excuse me for getting into that whole political thing, but something that's been on my mind, and it kind of relates.
There's a dissertation in there, John.
Yeah.
Social engineering and conditioned thinking.
Yeah. Okay. Maybe it's time for me to be the savior. I think I'll probably teach this sutta in a in a couple of weeks. It's called, I can't think of the Pali name, but it's called The City. And in that sutta, the Buddha describes, again, remember during his time, the problems, he uses the metaphor of a city right in front of him, and then going on to describe the problems that have arisen from ignorance within that city. And it's really interesting. And of course, it's applicable throughout time. It's applicable today. So I mentioned this, you know, thinking about these things and exposing myself to what's going on in the world more now than I ever did before. One of the other things that I've noticed is that it hasn't created agitation or fear, where I can think back at times, you know, when I was much younger, where it would have. I remember, I don't think Diane might remember this. I grew up during the time of the Cuban Missile Crisis and the time when we had air raids, and when the sirens went off, and every town did this, when the sirens went off, you were taught that you'd go immediately go into a basement because the bomb is coming. And that's the way it was presented. And I remember a time when I was about 6 or 7 walking home from school and the sirens went off. And I can still remember the fear that I had in me. And I ran to the closest house while I was walking home. They didn't know me, pounding on the door that the bombs are coming. Let me into your basement. And I look back on that now and I think, you know, I grew up in this. How could it not affect me?
They would have us like line up in the hallway and put our hands, our arms over our heads in the corridor.
Yep.
Right, like that would.
Because that would protect you.
That will, yeah, that'll protect you. So I mean,
we had room darkening shades.
Yeah.
In our house.
Yep.
Like blackout, so you couldn't see light out the door.
Yep.
I was like, what's that for? Like, you know, did we get wrong?
Yeah, the reason why you had blackouts is so that the bombers couldn't pinpoint you. They couldn't see you up in the sky. You know, again, this is the world we live in. It's not something we should focus on. It's not something we should lose our minds over. But we might be collectively as a human society in better shape if we would all realize that we haven't gotten past competitiveness and violence yet. There's still more work to do on ourselves on an individual level. We're so enamored with this whole, I mean, we're again talking about how we grew up. I grew up in, what was that song, the Dawning of a New Age of Aquarius? That all we have to do is continue to live, and we're going to somehow find ourselves in this grand, peaceful utopia. That's the underlying thinking. That's the underlying thing that's rooted in ignorance. That by doing the same thing over and over again, we're somehow going to end up somewhere different. How can we? Again, the Buddha recognized this 2,600 years ago, and he taught a way to change that. And at least we're here doing it. You know, perhaps more and more people will do the same. So, let peace and equanimity prevail. Ron, how's your meditation practice, and what benefits have you noticed?
I was just thinking about it before you broach that subject, how lately my work, which can get pretty complicated, and it could be called a source of stress, how there's been this wonderful ease in it. And when I examine that a little bit more, I realize that it is from applying at least some parts of the Eightfold Path. Mm-hmm. If I keep my eyes on right livelihood and right action, specifically, I think in not taking what's not freely given. And also the right speech, to keep that one in mind, it does create a situation where there's a lot more ease. There's a lot fewer things to worry about, because I've seen now that if I stay on that part of the path, things are working out pretty nicely.
Okay.
So, yeah, in that respect,
Thank you for saying that's why I asked. It is so, that's how it works, and that's why I asked the question. You know, to recognize the practical applications of the Dhamma and how it works. That's how it's supposed to work. Thank you. Mary, good to see you tonight.
Good to see everyone. I've had an experience this week where, I mean, like anybody who works in a corporate environment, no matter how high up the ladder you are or not, there are so many more what I call administrative things that we have to do, and we have to do them ourselves, and, you know, just, and you're going back and forth with somebody who has, like, the power to get you in trouble or on a list if you don't get your stuff in on time or whatever. It's like, and it's a train, and it's exhausting to a lot of people. I've heard, I don't know who it was, but there's someone else in the class that has talked about it. But she's in a helping field. And, you know, I've heard my brother talking about it. A lot of people are going through this, that as automation takes off, there's so many more things that maybe somebody else used to help you with, and now you got to do it all yourself. And it really can be a drain, and it's a drain on a lot of people who work for me, and it's just the way that things are right now. Plus, everything moves at such a fast speed, so you have to be really good at ticklers on your calendars and folders on your desktop and all this stuff to make sure you don't miss a deadline, because somebody somewhere is going to send a list out and you're on it, and, you know, all of that. And so I did two things. I became aware of two things that, oh, wow, I missed that deadline. And these aren't like earth-shaking things, but enough to create, attract attention. But two things. And then I really just thought them through, and I thought them through my last week, and I thought about how I approach my work, what my intentions are, how I organize myself, how... And resigned myself that I haven't done everything I could, you know, that this person is capable of. But before I did that, I was preparing for what I was perceiving as a very difficult conversation with my boss, something that might have even been embarrassing for me. Why did you miss that deadline? You shouldn't have that, you know, like that kind of stuff doesn't play well in my head. And so I was kind of preparing for that call, which is then being defensive. And finally I was like, you know, oh, hey, I only missed two things this week. That's really good. And I really just thought about it enough, not analyzed it, but just like let it flow until I didn't even bring it up in the conversation. I was going to be proactive and bring it up in the conversation with my boss, and I didn't even bring it up because it wasn't right view. It was clinging on to mental fabrications in my head, things that I'm afraid of or don't want to get blamed for or whatever. And I didn't even bring it up. And if he wants to bring it up, it's okay, because I'm at peace. Like that little deadline, nobody died, you know. And I don't mean to, and I don't mean to suggest I'm being cavalier, another word I worry about. But I'm not being cavalier, because I really did look back and I had done everything I could possibly do. I have a commute and a territory that sometimes has me in a car 4 to 6 hours in a day, and you're still trying to fit 8 to 10 hours in. So if I came home and went to the gym instead of getting back online, and therefore didn't get it into a Friday rather than Thursday, I cannot be the only person that had that experience, and therefore it's okay. And that just happened like in the last day. I took 2 days off from work, yesterday and today, to be with my family, and that's how that bubbled up and said, you know, that can't be right with you to be having angst about this. Anyway, I don't want to go on and on about it, but it really just became a piece that some, the kind of stuff that I probably garnered steam and passion and all sorts of things my whole life, because I self-identify with a hard worker and timely and responsible and all these things, right? And these behaviors might suggest otherwise. And they don't suggest anything. It just suggests that it's a highly automated world and we're all busy, and It's okay, and it's going to be okay. And I'm going to do better today and tomorrow and the next day, you know?
I'm smiling because I don't remember. Were you here? I think it was Tuesday when I gave the talk on Fena Sutta.
I think
so. What you're describing, this fabrication that you were coming up against,
mm-hmm.
because of your realization, was in the Fena Sutta, the Buddha says it's like foam on the water. There's
right.
nothing there.
Right.
When you let go of it, you realize there's nothing there.
Right.
And it's not, again, and you said it part, you don't have to analyze it to figure out how you got there. How can you analyze foam on the water?
Right.
You just get caught up and there's nothing there, let it go.
You know, one other thing that I recently let go of through this work in the Eightfold Path, you may remember a time that Helen and I brought up when my father passed. And even in that moment, it was like right there in my throat, you know, and it was a long time ago. Well, and I remember listening to the tape. I remember hearing Helen and I have that experience. And I listened to it, and I was like, let it go. It doesn't matter. You know, it's all good. It you don't need to carry that with you today.
Yeah.
Happened a long time ago when you're, you know, an adult, and it's okay.
Yeah.
And it turns out, you know, today happens to be the anniversary. And one of my younger sisters put something out on Facebook, and it was just really nice. I didn't expect her to put something out. Many people knew him, many people know us, and and there it was, just out there, and different members of my family chiming in, and people chiming in, and it was all just foam on the ocean. And I don't mean that with any disrespect,
no,
of course.
It's all it is.
It just happened, and it's just happened.
Yeah.
Where... You know, I don't know how many months ago that was, where, you know, it was as if it had happened yesterday.
Yeah.
It was still very present with me. And, you know, this is a much better place to be.
Yeah, it is.
And that's all through the Eightfold Path, for sure.
It doesn't change anything that goes on.
No, it just changes how I think about it.
Yeah, it changes how you think. It changes your...
You have that...
It changes your view. From
right.
a wrong view rooted in ignorance to a right view that's rooted in wisdom. It just means we understand what's going on.
And how empowering that it's all within reach.
Yeah.
That it's all within a matter of time to dedicate to this, to develop the Eightfold Path.
Yeah, persevering effort.
Yeah, in order to just have a calm and peaceful life. It's okay.
Thank you, Mary.
Thank you.
Keith, good to see you tonight. How's your practice going, and what benefits have you gained?
Well, I've been traveling a lot, and I hate flying. And normally, I get super anxious. I have to take Xanax to fly. My practice has been going very well. Much more calm. I don't know if I say tranquil. I'm getting there. So this time when I flew, I was at peace. I didn't have to take Xanax.
Wow.
I still took the Xanax. But I didn't have to take it. I recognize that's something completely different.
Because of the condition, thinking you took
yes.
it anyway.
But it's absolutely helping, so thank you.
Again, thank you for sharing that. That's how it works. Practical benefits. So, thanks, Keith. Diane, good to see you tonight.
Thank you. Thank you again for your steadfastness, love for what you teach. One example out of many happening in my life, I started working for someone this afternoon, and I thought, when I walked in, they didn't greet me, they didn't say anything, and it was like they just expected me to go do what I do. And I thought, the thought started, they don't appreciate me. Doggone it, I'm going to go find another client, I'm going to let these people go, and I'm going to find people who really appreciate me. And I was watching the thoughts. And I thought, gee, I've thought that many, many times. And it didn't really get me anywhere. You know, I didn't feel good. I mean, this is basically what was going through my head. And I thought, what if I just let it go and just do my job? Duh. And not think these things. And I did, and I really found I had more energy to do my job, and I had I was actually enjoying it. And at the end of the time that I was with this client, she came out when we had a wonderful conversation, and it really, I mean, just her presence was saying, and I listened to her. She just needed to talk. She's a black person, and she talk about clinging and craving to her history and what the black people have gone through in this country, especially, and still are facing. But, you know, everybody needs somebody to listen to them. And I was happy to do that. And it's just realizing the thought eventually popped up in the beginning of the time was, I don't need anybody to appreciate me. That's okay. And from then on, it was good. So I think that's a right view.
I think so too.
I'm practicing it, and I'm very, wrong, and everyone is saying it. It's so much weight off of my mind. It's like it's, you know, I'm almost lightheaded. L-I-G-H. Is that right? Anyway,
thank you, Diane. Again, it's just a practical example of how it works. We are so fortunate that we have a way of developing along the way ever increasing calm and peace and happiness. So, thanks, Bonnie. Good to see you tonight.
Nice to see you
too. How are you?
So, I experienced the benefits, and I experienced, you know, I talked about last week, standing in the light of kind of going through, like, to remember to take into consideration quality of mind where I am and allowing it that it's going to be this way, but for me to try to get out of the way, to step aside from the arrows that, you know, come towards me. And so sometimes I'm still in the way. But remembering just that I will get through this, and to be calmer about it, and the spaciousness helps to step back, and, you know, also that I have a lot of supports for sometimes I need to just discuss it, because when I discuss it, then I get my view enlarges, and then I understand. Or sometimes, you know, I'll call Liz, and she'll say something very wise and get me to just step back right from the gate, and it's like, and it does make all the difference, and it shifts everything in it, so what I try to do is to remind myself, so when I see this particular thing or this aspect of some very difficult work that I face, that to remember that it is fabricated, like the hard stuff for me, right? That it is fabricated, to remember where I come from, and that I come from, you know, from kindness, and to be with whether it's my students or my clients. So, you know, it's always been ongoing in my head that the conversations that I have help, of course, to get myself to step back and have a different view. So for me, the view is always most important.
That's great. And recognizing how your view affects what's going on, how you experience your life. Thank you. Liz, good to see you tonight.
Good to see you, too. I think the aspect of being at peace with a less than peaceful state of mind has been key to a key to leading to the benefits of this practice. It's so easy to sort of spiral out of control or spiral out of of acceptance of a situation when you're in that mind state of you know, dependent origination, and it's just, you know, well, you all know. But being at peace with a less than peaceful state of mind, and one of the ways I'm trying to counteract the effects of some of the things that are going on in the world right now is that I'm writing a letter to Donald Trump, and I'm going to share some of this with him in a non-specific kind of way, and just kind of do it and send it off, and maybe do it once a week.
I think that's a great idea. Ed, you know, tell him if he wants to learn more, he can visit us here.
More for me than for him, but
you never know, though, Liz. You know, he may say that sounds pretty good. How'd you come to that?
Yeah, John.
Yeah, maybe if it hits his head on the rear of the car.
On the trunk of the car.
On the trunk of the car.
Every human being has the potential to awaken. He's far from King Ashoka, and King Ashoka did it. So.
Yeah.
Anyway, I know it's a little delusional.
I don't think so. I think it's practical. I really do. I may do the same thing. I'm going to send him a copy of the book anyway.
I'm just going to even tell him to take 3 breaths before you tweet. Start there.
Start there.
Well, so we'll find out pretty quickly if he takes 2 of them.
Monday.
Thank you, Liz. Lorna, good to see you.
You say you're watching the news a little bit more frequently now.
Yeah.
I don't know if over the last couple of days you've noticed that William and Harry and Kate from the
Royal Family
have just started a new charity or something, and it's about, what do you call it, talking head, I think it is, and it's about recognising how much stress people are under. It's not like food and stuff, but it's recognising, just in a general sense of the word, you know, how much stress people are under and how much stress they're under. They've spoken about their position in life and how it causes them stress. Mm-hmm. And anyway, it's just sort of a new, it's a little bit of a new outlook on supporting people who've had mental illness, mental problems, this sort of stuff. And the sort of the statistics that they go with in Great Britain is about 1 in 3 adults have problems, mental problems, that are worthy of professional help, is what they say. Which is kind of staggering.
Yeah, anyway, it is. But the statistics are probably the same here.
Yeah. Well, I know, it's very similar, but I'm just saying it's what you don't understand, for the royal family, to support this is huge.
Oh, I think it's astonishing.
It is astonishing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right.
Mental illness has been at the bottom of health for, you know, decades, and it's now been realized, to now the royal family are supporting mental health issues and etc. So I'm just saying that.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's remarkable that they admit that they are suffering from stress too. Most people would think, well, the royal family, they got everything they could ever want. There can't be any stress in their life.
No.
The Buddha left the kingdom because of the stress that was there in his life.
Yes.
Still a problem. You can't escape the First Noble Truth, no matter what your position, no matter what your status is. Dukkha occurs. So, thank you for sharing that. Frank, good to see you tonight.
It's good to be here, John. Thank you. My practice is going good. And last week was a pretty busy week for us in the bakery with Easter, and I don't know, I feel like I've been able to apply the Eightfold Path every day in my life so far, for like the last couple weeks. Like, I don't get it, I don't understand when it happened, when I'm able to be in the mix of chaos and mayhem and be able to see right view and set a right intention and stay in right speech and take the right action and make the right effort. And I had to change my my practice up a little bit because I didn't have 20 minutes to sit down and meditate one shot. So I was breaking it out over the whole day, 10 minutes, 10 minutes, 10 minutes, like spreading it out because I was at work 12 hours a day, 14 hours a day. And what I noticed, especially like I work with family, so I have a lot of history with them. A lot of our employees have been there for 20, 30, 40 years. So I used to bring up old information into the database in my mind and kind of get discouraged about somebody's behavior right away. And I've been able to let all that stuff go and forget about. Like, it's like trying to fly an airplane in last week's weather. You know?
That's perfect.
And it's like,
that's crazy.
So really the only thing that changed was my view. Like, how I see things.
Yeah.
And that has, like, everyone's saying, like, the weight is lifted off, you know. Because I experienced, like, I wasn't being insensitive earlier when I said about the neurosis and, like, the people that I work with, people that I experience life with on a daily basis. I'm a part of it. I used to be a part of that. I used to use drugs and alcohol to escape that suffering and created my own psychosis and neurosis, and being able to live today substance free and be totally at peace and not have to change the events in my life to like arrange the ducks in a row for myself and arrange the outside world and let just things be as they are, and it's going to be okay because it's my experience in life that really dictates my suffering. It's like, oh, the mind, my mind is the source of happiness or suffering, and I can choose today what I want.
Yeah.
You know, so I'm grateful.
I'm grateful for what you just said. That it's just remarkable. It's about a year and a half since you started this Dhamma practice, right? I have that time frame correct?
December 28th.
Remember the day?
So, Tuesday night class.
And in that relatively short period of time, what you're describing tonight is you've went from a profound wrong view of life to a profound right view. And that change in view has now changed your experience of your life. And I would say, and the people around you, you have changed their experience of you to them too. It's just, it really is remarkable. And I guess that's why I wanted to speak specifically to these changes that this practice makes. All we have to do is do it. Persevering effort. So, thank you. It really is remarkable. Joe, good to see you tonight. How are you?
It's good to be here. Okay. My mind's really noisy. I guess that I do sit. It's just really noisy in there.
Yeah.
All the things that I supposed are becoming validated by what I've been studying. You're on a lot in the house, so I listen to the talks, regardless of whether I could absorb. Sometimes I can sit down and focus, and other times it's just on. I don't know. I guess if you get 100 people and you're on a imaginary planet and you teach them that red is stop and green is go, and this is left and this is right, and then you just say see you later, they'll all be able to function more or less as humans together. And then when boy meets girl at the red light, and the boy says, wow, I think that girl's checking me out, and the girl is thinking, well, look at that guy, he thinks he's so cool, or whatever. So that, you know, the stories are so, you don't really have any idea what's going on in someone else's head, and everyone has their own agenda, their own story, and their own focus. And I guess that's why it's so noisy inside my head, because I think about ridiculous things.
And you are not unique at all. That is, you're describing the common human problem. Nearly everyone I've ever taught, and forget about that, nearly everyone I've ever met that came to any type of meditation practice, the first thing they said is, I got this mind that just won't stop. The Buddha recognized that too. That's why he taught meditation within the broader framework. And I would say you're developing it nicely. You haven't been coming all that long at all. And the fact that you recognize that there's another way to be and you're engaging in persevering effort assures that through that effort you'll develop a calm and peaceful mind. You know, again, the Buddha offers those guarantees that once you develop it, you'll have the same experience that he had of being an awakened human being. You know, again, it's what gets me, well, let me go on to get into another subject, but all that we need to do is to develop it, and then we have the benefits of it. You know, we don't have to do anything else. We don't have to add anything to it. We can just meditate and develop the Eightfold Path, and lasting peace and happiness is ours. So, thank you, Joe. Any other questions or comments before we conclude with metta? Okay, so yeah, we will conclude with metta. I don't think I have any. Our retreat is coming up less than a month. If you haven't signed up and you are going, just please do it as soon as you can. It helps my logistical planning a lot. But you can also tell me you're coming on the last day, and that would be fine too.
You're sleeping in the bottom of it.
Yeah, be in the bottom. Nothing we can do about that. There's plenty of room still left. Any other announcement is, I think you all know I'm teaching on Thursday nights here too, so I'll see you all back here then. So find your relaxed meditative posture. Oh, a good question. No, me and Matt talked about it, and we just have too much going on. So we'll do it in the week of Thanksgiving, Tuesday of Thanksgiving week, but there won't be a spring dinner this year. Just too much going on, which is, I mean, all good stuff. So find your relaxed meditative posture and gently close your eyes and gently close your mouths and take a moment to become aware of the sensation of breathing in your body and let that mindfulness of your breath cease any distracting thoughts to the past or to the future, or that may have arisen from our talk tonight. And these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing, in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class. Peace.
Thank you for listening. Please visit crossrivermeditation.com for guided meditations and instruction, and Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos. We rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at crossrivermeditation.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Please feel free to contact me through crossrivermeditation.com. Peace.